Rob, thank you very much indeed. I will hand it over to Kevin. Our next speaker is Dr. Kevin Farnsworth. Kevin is Reader in Social Policy at the University of York, and he's published widely on business and public policy and corporate power. His books include Social Policy and Corporate Power, Social versus Corporate Welfare, Social Policy in Challenging Times, and Social Policy in Terms of Austerity. And he's the Director of Corporate Welfare Watch. Kevin.
Okay, I want to begin by thanking CIOT and the IFS and her in particular for inviting me along and to you for all coming along as well and listening to this important debate. So the title is Business Tax Reliefs, Corporate Welfare or Essential Elements of the Tax System. I approach this question slightly differently, I think, to others, and I have lots to get through, which is why I'm not using the PowerPoint at all, because that will just delay me. And actually, this is more scripted than my my stuff would normally be, but if you'll forgive me, because otherwise I won't get through what I need to. Also, there's a risk that I will repeat some things that have already been said, but I'll try to skirt over those bits a little bit. This question that we're debating, as I said today, corporate welfare or essential elements of the tax system, I'm going to talk to the corporate welfare bit of it. And it's a really important question. But I would argue that actually it's slightly the wrong question and it's posed in slightly the wrong way. And I want to try to illustrate that by developing three key points. First of all, tax reliefs are part of, I would argue, the broader corporate welfare system. I would argue that it's entirely possible, though, for tax reliefs both to be an essential part of the tax system and constitute corporate welfare. The problem with tax reliefs is not that they operate as corporate welfare for me and for my work, but in some ways, some aspects provide the wrong kind of corporate welfare and in the wrong way and often in the wrong quantity. That's the first point. The second point. Tax reliefs are relatively blunt policy tools, or they can be. There's ample evidence to suggest, and some of that we've already heard today, and I'm going to talk about some more, that tax reliefs are not always the most efficient, effective, and transparent way of delivering support to businesses. And make no mistake, states assist businesses in all kinds of ways. They always have, actually. I'm not going to argue necessarily that there's much wrong with that. It depends on how they're assisted and also the broader question of the implications, I feel, for social welfare. But we might, because of the issues, want to explore alternative or complementary mechanisms of support. Thirdly, the UK needs to adapt. Rob mentioned Brexit. I wondered how long we'd get before we actually started talking Brexit. Well, I'm going to put it up front. The UK needs to adapt, it needs to evolve, it needs to develop a new competitive model going forward, I think. Brexit could change, actually, quite a lot. Of course, it might not change very much at all. It depends on the nature of the Brexit that we get. But I think because of that, we need to consider tax reliefs along other kinds of mechanisms going forward. We need to seriously scrutinise tax reliefs, ask what they're for, and ask what other mechanisms there might be that might complement tax reliefs. So, in turn, first of all, tax reliefs are part of the broader corporate welfare system. Why do I argue this? In my work, I draw a direct analogy between social welfare and corporate welfare, and that's where the social policy bit comes in. I define corporate welfare as the various direct and indirect cash and in-kind ways in which governments assist private businesses. Corporate welfare operates to pool and socialise risks, and tax reliefs also operate very often in a similar way. So tax reliefs and tax expenditures are not simply a matter of accountancy, and nor are they somehow ordained. They're not God-given. They operate very differently in different political contexts, or very often they do. They are politically engineered, and they have to be understood in the broader context. And that, often I think the debate is just far too narrow. They have to be looked at in a broader political and economic context. And as I said, that's true when we consider variability, not just between states, but also over time. The treatment of various tax allowances change. And we need to look at how tax reliefs fit into the whole fiscal mix. That's the first point. The second, that tax reliefs are relatively blunt and in some cases ineffective. Of course, there are a whole range of benefits for them. We've heard some of those arguments today. Tax reliefs can operate to redistribute the tax burden. They can increase the progressiveness of tax systems. They can incentivize particular desirable types of business behavior, and they can offset costs and risks associated with negative externalities, as Helen's already mentioned. But there are also risks involved in that, and I want to talk about some of those risks, and in doing so, I'm going to draw on some of the similar literature that we've been covering, that was being covered already. I want to, I suppose, draw attention, first of all, to the Public Accounts Committee, because if there's any parliamentary activity that's done most to put these issues on the political agenda, it's the Public Accounts Committee, especially in 2014-2015. Public Accounts Committee argued in 2015 that HMRC rarely, if ever, assess whether a tax relief is an economic, efficient and effective way of meeting its policy objectives. The general criticism that tax allowances and tax reliefs increase a lack of transparency, a lack of accountability, because they're simply not scrutinised in the way that other policy is. The second issue I want to deal with amongst the list of cons. Cost controls are often inadequate, and Rob's hinted at that with relation to entrepreneurs' relief, so I don't want to say very much more about that at this stage, but maybe we'll come to debate that. The third thing that... One point. HMRC actually did a review of... HMRC, although the criticism is that HMRC doesn't actually evaluate tax reliefs enough, they have been doing quite a lot more recently. But it's incredible to me that if you actually look at the reports that are commissioned, very often they say very similar things, that it's very difficult to find any discernible effects on business behaviour. HMRC launched a report in 2015 which actually concluded that about entrepreneurs' relief. The third thing that I want to talk about in relation to cons is that, drawing on the Public Accounts Committee again, tax reliefs are argued to incentivize tax avoidance and increase the risk of fraud. The National Audit Office, as Rob will probably testify, estimates that in excess of £4 billion per year is lost as a result of fraud. Related to tax relief. The Public Accounts Committee that argued that a range of tax reliefs have been used to systematically avoid taxation, and we've heard examples of that, the field tax relief, share loss relief, business premises renovation allowance. All of these things the Public Accounts Committee identified as being highly correlated with fraud and tax avoidance. There's another issue of tax breaks on debt interest, including group financing exemptions. Obviously, the Public Accounts Committee made a great deal about this in relation to Starbucks. But Charlie Elfink, as an MP, estimated that utility companies alone avoided £1 billion in tax because of these mechanisms that allowed into company lending. And resulted in tax avoidance for those particular companies. Because of that, the European Commission is currently investigating these kinds of rules as potential problems, a potential state aid. The patent box we've heard something about. The OECD argued that the patent box, which offers a 10% tax rate to high-tech firms, is an example of harmful tax practice. Even relatively non-contested reliefs, actually, like R&D tax credits. Helen is right about the positive things that I said about R&D tax credits. But there are also some, in terms of the economistic analysis of benefits that stem from R&D tax credits. The actual estimate of the return is highly variable. If you look at the research, it's highly variable. Again, HMRC in 2015 released a report that suggested that the relative gains could vary between zero and a ratio of 3.37, which highly variable in terms of its impact. More recently, the IPPAR did a systematic review of tax credits and actually argued that 80% of the expenditure on research and development tax credits didn't encourage a change of behaviour at all. Actually, that research and development would have occurred anyway without that kind of intervention. The Public Accounts Committee, again returning to its 2015 report, stated that although the expenditure on R&D tax credits increased from £100 million to over £1 billion in 10 years, company expenditure overall on R&D actually remained broadly the same. There's one more issue that I want to draw attention to in terms of the cons, which I think is potentially interesting. Work done by Mariana Mazzucato and John Watson suggests that one of the problems with tax reliefs is that actually they tend to divert attention away from more direct intervention. So there's nothing necessarily wrong with tax credits themselves, but actually that they, in a way, they cried out additional direct spending. And so they make comparisons with Germany and France and argue that the UK, in terms of tax credits, is relatively generous. In terms of direct provision, is not. And so we need to ask whether or not they're encouraging the right kinds of policy work at the national level. The TUC adds to these kinds of concerns, arguing that actually, in their analysis of tax allowances, that they tend to overwhelmingly go to the wealthier parts of the UK. Now, that's understandable in a way, but it has Brexit implications. Because as regional development begins to disappear, if we simply rely too heavily on tax allowances, then we risk leaving parts of the UK behind. Now, that brings me to my third issue. This will be hopefully I'll try to make this quite brief. My argument here is that the UK needs to adapt, and we do need a Brexit strategy going forward. The key point is that tax reliefs offer one way of bending policy to achieve particular aims, but as the Public Accounts Committee argued, in the case of non-structural reliefs in particular, a lot of policy objectives could actually be achieved in different ways. Most reviews of tax reliefs argue that actually there's a good rationale to simplify them, to reduce their number, to scrutinise them. I wouldn't dispute any of that, and I agree with those things. I think it's really important to have a more honest and open debate about them. But I also think it's time to rethink tax reliefs, because in the wake of Brexit, we're going to have to draw on a different range of policy tools to find ways of rejigging the prevailing system of corporate and social welfare. And the key question that we need to ask is how such support will be provided in future. Should we target more support on compensating businesses who face greater exporting costs? Should we invest more in the supply chain, as Nissan has argued? We should certainly invest more in human capital and use public policy, including tax reliefs, to resist David Davis's Mad Max world, which he painted a frightening picture of. But I think that kind of world, the risk is that will have appeal in some quarters. Certainly, leaving the EU changes the nature of the debate, around state aid in particular, and may provide the UK with a bit more wriggle room outside of state aid rules if that's where the UK is heading. But regardless of what happens post-Brexit, the problem is tax reliefs in and of themselves are relatively blunt tools, and often too much emphasis is placed on them. They operate as part of a wider corporate welfare system, A system of give and take with wide-ranging implications for a whole range of non-fiscal policy areas. And we need to look at how they operate alongside a whole range of direct forms of provision to deliver not only for businesses but also for citizens. Now, I'm pretty certain that achieving a Brexit that works for everyone will probably require more, not less, support measures in place for businesses. But as I said, I think this also has to work for citizens. And we have to find new ways of supporting businesses through difficult times, certainly. But we also have to find ways of ensuring this is not at the expense of citizens' welfare. And it will have to be funded through greater public investment and a redistribution of the tax burden, which in the UK is... I would argue, relatively low. At least it is if we take into account the whole corporate income taxes and national and employers' national insurance contributions, and we compare that nationally. We can say more about that in the questions if you like. Trimming tax reliefs possibly could help fund or divert expenditure into alternative forms, but maybe it's not. It's more important to increase direct provision, for example, through Innovate. UK through making up the last lack of regional development grants that the UK risks losing as part of Brexit. So my conclusion would be that going forward, we have to scrutinise tax reliefs much more. We have to think about what they achieve, and we have to look at a whole range of policy areas and how they relate to other aspects of fiscal and non-fiscal policy. Tax reliefs will continue to be important in certain areas. But in a more testing policy environment, I would argue, they will continue to provide only partial answers. And I'll leave it there.